Welcome to today's episode of the Tobacco Cessation Podcast. My name is Anna Giulio, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rebecca Alegria. Today, we're going to share with you a conversation we had with Shirlene Jean from the state of Massachusetts on what the state is doing to help menthol tobacco users quit in light of their state regulations removing the sale of menthol cigarettes.
So, Anne, as an expert in the field, can you share a little bit with us about why this is important or why this conversation was important to have, and just more about why menthol is an important topic?
Yeah, Rebecca, that's a great question. So we know that people who use menthol cigarettes are disproportionately impacted by them. Over 80% of Black individuals who smoke use a menthol cigarette product, which is far higher than other groups. There are also other disparities, including individuals that identify as LGBTQ+, as well as others. We also know menthol cigarettes tend to be easier to start and harder to quit. That's all the bad news. The good news is that the FDA proposed regulations back in April of 2022 to end the sale of menthol cigarettes. This has the potential to help and encourage a lot of individuals to quit smoking, including those who use menthol cigarettes. So it's really important that states, you know, put in place programs and have culturally competent resources to help those individuals that want to make a quit attempt, make that quit attempt.
Awesome. Thank you for that background. Now we will hear from Shirlene. Be back in a little bit.
Shirlene, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm an ambivert who enjoys beef steaks and tacos. On a more serious note, though, I'm the Community Cessation Coordinator with the Massachusetts Tobacco Cessation and Prevention Program at the Mass Department of Public Health. My work allows me to use my social work training to facilitate discussions that help organizations redefine their objectives to impact the health inequities faced by the communities they serve. So at MTCP, that's looked like providing project leadership for establishing and implementing strategies that reimagine access to tobacco and nicotine treatment beyond clinical settings, as well as leading efforts within our behavioral health and mental health settings.
That's quite a job that you have, and it's very impressive. Kind of digging in a little bit, how did addressing health inequities become a priority for the state of Massachusetts? And what specific data did you look at to kind of understand those inequities?
Addressing health inequities is one of the pillars of the Massachusetts Tobacco Cessation and Prevention Program, or MTCP. For short, when we looked at our data, we saw who was more likely to smoke cigarettes, who was more likely to use mentholated tobacco products, who was successful in a quit attempt, and who wasn't. And across the board, these individuals all share similar characteristics, such as reporting poor mental health, making less than $25,000 a year, living in multi-unit housing, or having state Medicaid insurance, among other things.
And we know that this issue affects different communities disproportionately. Can you share a little bit more about the importance of contextualizing the data and how this helped your state specifically to frame your goals?
Yes, because when we examine the data, if we provide data without context, it can either reinforce negative stereotypes, blame individuals, or present conditions as naturally occurring. It plays into a dominant narrative of how we diagnose and treat poverty in America. For example, poor people make poor decisions or choices that lead to poor health. However, we name the structures or conditions that shape our behaviors and lead with race explicitly but not exclusively. Race is a primary indicator of someone's health status, given that other forms of identity or status don't explain inequities alone. We can now ask better questions about our data. For example, despite having similar rates of smoking and quit attempts compared to whites, Blacks and Hispanics in Massachusetts consistently have lower rates of success for quitting, even after adjusting for income. Some structures and conditions that may explain this include Black and Hispanic people live in neighborhoods where prices for menthol products, example Newports, were intentionally lowered. There are also higher numbers of retailers that sell tobacco nicotine products in these neighborhoods, so people living in these neighborhoods have more exposure to the products. And we know that mint and menthol products are biologically more addictive and harder to quit. As a result of context setting, we reframe tobacco nicotine use and dependency as the exposure, use, and chemical change in the brain caused by nicotine. And now our analysis of successful quit attempts is more accurate and can inform better programming and interventions. We can shift our focus from cessation as a one-time event to facilitating and sustaining supportive environments for tobacco nicotine recovery, reducing bias in care systems, integrating trauma-informed and other appropriate interventions.
Definitely agree with you, and the context is very important in when you're presenting data. And of course, I'm sure that all of this data and looking at it, all the work that you're doing has led to a lot of services and different things that you have available. Can you share more about how these services are promoted to the public and health systems, and how are you tailoring this to your specific population?
So sure, cessation services are promoted via our medical provider communication channels, strategic partnerships with state Medicaid programs, other state health programs, as well as our community provider networks. We promote quitting resources by leveraging our regional community-based partnership programs via earned media opportunities and implementing cessation campaigns via paid media like social media, digital media, and sometimes out of home, such as billboards and transit. We also promote our special programs offered by our Quitline services by using the appropriate networks, partners, and gatekeeping organizations to reach specific populations like pregnant and postpartum, behavioral health, American Indian, Native American, and youth and young adult programs.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It really seems like you've done a very holistic approach and made a very holistic approach. Just out of curiosity, has there been any differences in the approaches in how you address mental and how you're asking providers to make some of those differences and adopt some of those different strategies?
Yes, in examining the impact of finances on behavior, we noted how economic instability can lead to increased stress and may help sustain smoking behaviors as a coping mechanism. So we hypothesized that offering an incentive would encourage engagement with the Quitline. When we worked with our community-based organizations to understand the cessation needs in community, we heard loudly and clearly that we didn't want to play into a narrative of taking something from community. We heard community members often use menthlated products to manage stress. So in addition to the long-term advantage of getting their health back, and the effectiveness of financial incentives, we wanted to give something back, in this case a financial incentive, to communities who are used to having things taken away from them. We also ensured that our mental program had quit coaches who were trained in racial equity principles. And in our communication to providers, we set the context for the data so they can consider the issues and their roles in addressing the inequities perpetuated by healthcare systems.
That makes a ton of sense, and you know, it's really inspiring to hear what you've been doing and kind of how you've worked to achieve the successes you have. One question I keep thinking is, how do you keep providers engaged? How do you reach them or keep them interested, especially with how busy their schedules can be and just generally overwhelmed they can be?
Yes, absolutely. We keep providers engaged via the outreach by our technical assistance and capacity building providers. So our TA providers provide skills training, systems assessment, and workflow change recommendations, CEU opportunities, among other capacity building efforts. We also improved our provider reimbursement by including the CPT code 99406 for brief interventions as payable for our state Medicaid program. We're also working on increasing provider outreach via gatekeeping organizations like Massachusetts Medical Society, American Medical Association, or others.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, I think you may have referenced QuitWorks previously, but, you know, kind of how did QuitWorks help your state providers connect people to the resources that they need?
So QuitWorks is a proactive feedback referral system that facilitates providers connecting their patients or clients to Quit resources. Referrals can happen via fax, online, or e-fax. It has been a great resource to remove issues with time constraints that many providers contend with, so to your earlier question. So what we've done to frame the resources as a systemic issue, we've shifted how we think and talk about quitting tobacco from individual behavior to examining systems that create and sustain inequities in quitting. In the traditional frame, we would define the problem as lower success in quitting among BIPOC communities, which is Black, Indigenous, people of color communities, and people who report poor mental health. With the racial justice frame, as an example, we can focus on one structural aspect which contributes to lower success in quitting among BIPOC and people who report poor mental health, namely that they are less likely to be screened and offered evidence-based cessation treatments by healthcare providers. So integrating QuitWorks into clinical care is a great way to challenge those assumptions and biases that happen in healthcare by implementing these processes that reduce the inequity in optimal care.
So obviously there's resources out there. They're there for people. Do you have any particular advice on engaging grassroots to increase access to these types of services?
My advice would be to engage community early and often. Identifying community champions is important to building trust and confidence in the services you're advocating for. Providers can also be community champions. So expand your idea of provider to include all staff, especially quality improvement professionals. Sometimes the person with the most influence in the office doesn't wear a white coat. These gatekeepers can help increase access of services within organizations and extend them to other sites.
Staying with on the advice track, do you have any advice to other state tobacco programs looking to address inequalities, especially those in menthol product use?
My advice to other state tobacco programs looking to address inequities, especially menthol product use, is always challenge your assumptions about the problems and solutions. Challenge assumptions by re-examining data and providing context to tell better stories. Empower communities to tell their own stories that support your new analysis. And even when community stories don't align with your data, that's an opportunity to continuously reframe to meet community needs, optimize community assets, and mobilize people power for action.
Charlene, everything you have said so far this afternoon has been incredibly inspiring. What's next for you and your team?
Sky's the limit. Some of the things that we're looking at is implementing recommendations from a recent quality improvement study to increase awareness of resources amongst our providers like QuitWorks, continuing to educate on the importance of expanding reimbursement for more types of providers, continue to build infrastructure for community cessation or community systems of care, and integrating trauma-informed approaches to our tobacco, nicotine use, and dependency service delivery and capacity building.
That's really exciting, and I'm super excited to kind of see what you guys can do. You know, I know we've covered a lot, but is there anything else that you'd like to add that we didn't have a chance to discuss today?
I think it's important to note that people have multiple simultaneous identities occurring. I think our analysis and programming benefit when we utilize frameworks that understands and uplifts intersectionality.
Well, thank you so much. That really is very important, and recognizing that nobody is just one single person. So that's a great way to end, and it's been really lovely talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was a really great conversation. Charlene is such a wealth of knowledge, and I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to talk to her today. I learned so much. Rebecca, what were a couple things that you really took out of that?
Yeah, I agree. She definitely had a lot of important topics to share with us. I think one of the main ones that I took away was the importance of context when looking at data. She talked about how if you are given data without the context, a lot of the times it can be taken in a different way than intended to. So I think it's just important to always remember to have context when sharing data and when looking at it. And then she also talked about how the Medicaid program expanded treatments available, so to have more counseling codes. And she specifically mentioned 99406, so just more treatments available to help people quit. And then she also talked about challenging your assumptions. So I think that's something that we should all take away from it to as we continue to do work.
No, that's great. This was such a great conversation with Charlene. Please feel free to check out more resources at the American Lung Association's website. www.lung.org. And we really look forward to talking with you next time. Thank you. Bye.